Jeff leads the eelgrass stressor response program in DNR's Aquatic Resources Division. That's Department of Natural Resources. His research focuses on stressors that affect eelgrass and effective ways to restore this critical habitat throughout Puget Sound. And then Micah leads the climate change and ocean acidification work at DNR. And they're going to talk to you one right after the other, and then setting up the pattern for the day, they're gonna leave 5 minutes or so before the next presenter for questions from you. When you're ready with a question, please move to the mic at either side of the room and speak your question into the mic so the room can hear it, and we'll get an answer from our presenters. So, Jeff and Micah.
Thank you, Scott. Good morning, everybody, and thank you for being here. So today, Micah and I are going to provide an overview of eelgrass restoration and its potential to counteract ocean acidification in South Puget Sound. I think we're all aware of the ecosystem services eelgrass provides. Its ecological importance and role as an indicator species has prompted the partnership to identify it as a vital sign and select and establish a recovery goal of 20% more eelgrass. A recovery strategy was identified and developed two approaches to reach that recovery goal. Those are stressor reduction and restoration. I'm going to speak to you about the restoration component of the recovery strategy. Restoration is a multi-step adaptive process. We developed a model to help identify... Why is that getting bigger? That's weird. Sorry. We developed a model to help identify suitable sites for restoration. This is one example of the model output, where green areas indicate positive biomass production and positive or suitable sites for restoration, whereas the red areas are not so suitable for restoration. From that model output, it gets filtered. We then can identify or hone in on a site to do test transplants. We evaluate those test transplants for 6 to 12 months, and then after evaluation, we determine whether or not a site is suitable for a large-scale restoration effort. This map shows the restoration efforts conducted in South Puget Sound between 2013 and 2018. The red or the green dots and squares indicate test transplants and large-scale transplants that were successful, and the red dots are those that are unsuccessful. The small chia-like structures or symbols in the map are our donor sites. Most of the transplanting during this period was done with the horizontal rhizome method and using staples, the picture in the upper right-hand corner. So for the rest of the talk, Micah and I are going to focus on this site here, Joemma Beach State Park. Joemma Beach State Park is on the southwest part of Key Peninsula on Case Inlet. Over the years, we've conducted a number of large-scale transplants at this site and also other transplant studies. We're gonna zoom in and look at the inset photo in the far right part of this image, where we have three different color polygons on the bottom part. Those are the sites we're gonna talk about today. Getting a little closer to those sites, you can see some eelgrass transplants here in rows, patch there, and then three polygons below that. And those were later year or more recently planted. All the transplants were planted. This is getting worse, is it? Look at that one. All transplants were transplanted using transplanted at different densities. And the 2015 and 2017 transplants were transplanted using staple method, and the 2016 was a slight modification. We wove plants into burlap and planted those, putting them down on the sediment and securing them with staples and a little bit of sediment on top. So zooming into the site number one, the transplants here were planted across five transects at a density of 80 shoots per meter squared for a total of 125 square meters of vegetated plants. The image on the left shows the transplant 1 year after transplanting, and you can see that there's some void spots the plants are sparse. This is 2 years afterwards, so this is encouraging. And our data supports what is seen in the image. We have an increase in shoot density across both sites over the 3 years of monitoring. One exception being in 2016, transect 5 had a slight decrease in shoot density. One other thing to note is the number of shoots per meter squared across these two sites. Transect 4 has a much higher shoot density than transect 5, and that's a result of the donor sites. The donor sites used on transect, or the donor plants used on transect 4 were much smaller and naturally grow at a higher shoot density than the plants used on transect 5. And this transferred over to the recipient site. As you can imagine, we also had an increase in eelgrass area over this time frame. Initially, eel area decreased in the first year following transplanting, but then we had a significant increase in 2017 and 2018 across both of these transects. When we take the whole site and combine all the values from the five transects, we see a twofold increase, or a 2.5-fold increase in eelgrass area shown by this green polygon, and the total number of eelgrass plants at the site has a 6-fold increase over these last 3 years since transplanting. Now moving down to the next site, this was the one planted with a slightly different method using burlap. The image on the left is 1 year after transplanting. The image on the right is 2 years after transplanting this past summer. And you can already see that there's some infilling happening over in this area in there. So we can imagine that there's been an increase in shoot density. And that was the case over these last 2 years at this site. We haven't measured area at the site, and that's something we plan to do in the future. And finally, sites 3 through 5 were planted last summer. These were planted at a density of 160 shoots per meter squared. And initially, as expected with most restoration, we lose shoots after the first year. And this was the case at these sites. We're hoping that the established shoots that are there will grow and recover and perform much like the two sites I just presented earlier. So that summarizes the restoration efforts at Joanna Beach State Park. Now Mike is going to demonstrate how those different age restorations affect water quality.
All right, thank you, Jeff. So Jeff mentioned the benefits that eelgrass has for the provision of habitat, and some of you may also know that grass prevents erosion and protects shorelines in that way. And I've been really excited to partner with him to see whether or not grass can have any sort of benefit for local water quality and water chemistry. So I'm gonna kind of provide two problems that eelgrass might address. And if restoration addresses those problems, then it's a practical tool for us to manage shorelines. So the first is low oxygen. This is a picture of a fish kill in Case Inlet right here in South Puget Sound. And these happen in, this I will not say is caused by climate change. It is just a natural low oxygen condition that caused the fish to rise to the surface and then die. But warmer water holds less oxygen, so we can probably expect a higher incidence of fish kills in the future as our water's warm. And one benefit that seagrass might have in counteracting fish kills in low oxygen zones is that it produces oxygen through photosynthesis like all plants do. So we set out to measure whether or not these restored patches of grass are going to have a measurable effect on local oxygen levels. So here's the same map that Jeff just laid out for us. There's the site. And I'm going to focus on the newest and the oldest restoration patches to see whether the maturity of the grass there has had any effect on water chemistry. And the way I'm going to present these data is showing you what a typical day looks like in and outside of an eelgrass meadow. So here you can see is midnight to midnight. These dark areas on the figure are nighttime when the sun is down, and then the yellow area in the middle is when the sun is up. And then right here is oxygen level. So what happens if there's no grass at all? This line right here represents if the water is just in equilibrium with the atmosphere. Oxygen is moving in and out of the water without respect to biology. So in the area with no grass, the bare spot in the newest meadow, this is what a typical day looks like. So you can kind of see that the shoreline itself is breathing. At nighttime, there's low oxygen. When photosynthesis starts up in the daytime, oxygen goes up, and then it goes back down into the nighttime. And what's happening in the restored eelgrass patch right next to there? In the 1-year-old eelgrass, We see the same pattern. There's no real difference there. The oxygen goes up a little bit during the day and then back down. So it doesn't appear that this new patch of grass is having any effect on oxygen. What about when we look at the more mature patch that was restored in 2015, 3 years ago? This is the control site for comparison. We see the same kind of thing. And then this is the pattern in oxygen inside the eelgrass meadow. So to me, when we look at these side by side, the one-year-old eelgrass and the three-year-old eelgrass, there's a pretty strong indication that the mature eelgrass improved local oxygen in the daytime inside of the meadow. So this does suggest that the grass's metabolism, the photosynthesis that it's undergoing, is having a measurable effect on water quality and pumping up oxygen during these periods of daylight. So there's one other problem that is getting a lot of attention that grass might also address, and that's ocean acidification. So here's a Pacific oyster, a little one before it's put out into the tide flats. And you can see this is a baby oyster that's raised at a favorable pH, and this is a baby oyster raised at an unfavorable pH. It's difficult for them to form their shells under these conditions, and pH is slowly getting worse because of the carbon dioxide that we're putting into the atmosphere. So the other side of photosynthesis, besides the production of oxygen, is the consumption of CO2. So we want to see whether the restoration is producing enough of a photosynthetic drawdown of carbon dioxide that it's improving pH and maybe making conditions better for shell-building animals. So I'm going to show this in exactly the same scheme as before. There's going to be nighttime to nighttime, daytime in the middle, but we're looking at pH now rather than oxygen. So what about the newest patch of eelgrass that was restored last year? You can see that pH is a little bit more variable than oxygen is, but you still see this increase during the daytime, and that's because of photosynthesis in the water of microorganisms, not just the grass. And then when we look at inside the new eelgrass patch, we see a general shift up in the pH, and these are not very far apart, as you can see on the map. It's a matter of, you know, hundreds of meters rather than miles. What about the more mature eelgrass patch? Here's the control site. pH is generally a little bit higher up there. And then here's what's happening in the eelgrass patch. This is a smoother curve you can see that has a really clear elevation of pH in the daytime. So let's look at those side by side. And here, again, we have some suggestion that the photosynthesis the eelgrass is performing is having an effect both in the newer patch and in the more mature patch. So to get at this question, we kind of need to ask it in multiple places around South Sound and outside of South Sound. And to do that, we've established this network called ANEMONE, the Acidification Nearshore Monitoring Network. And the goal of the whole program is to measure the progress of acidification and warming water in nearshore environments where most of what we care about lives, and to test practical options to address those changes. So whether eelgrass restoration is one of them is something we're trying to figure out. And this has been an exciting program to establish because we partner with locals at every one of these sites. And the science, the on-the-ground work, is performed in collaboration with people we call site guardians. So people who live around these sites and are willing to go out and help us collect the biological data and maintain the instruments that help us answer these questions about ocean acidification. So if you have any interest in partnering with us on this, please get in touch. And with that, I'll acknowledge all of the partners that have helped with the restoration work and the chemical monitoring. And I think Jeff and I have time for some questions. Thank you.
All right, so questions from the microphones. Betty, are you ready with a question? Okay, here we have a question.
Thank you, Micah and Jeff. Just out of curiosity, one of the other issues with eelgrass is it could sequester some carbon. Have you looked into how much we might increase the amount of eelgrass biomass? I mean, can we actually sequester much blue carbon here?
There has been some research on the sequestration rates of carbon by eelgrass, and unfortunately, it's not as high as we would hope and as comparable to tropical species like Posidonia or Thalassia. It does, what ends up happening is the carbon does get sequestered and bound in the biomass, and there is, in areas where there's high depositional zones, there's a greater potential for carbon sequestration or storage for that matter. But the plant material does senesce, it becomes detritus, and then it gets cycled back into the system. So it doesn't. It has the potential, and it's but it's not as great as our tropical similar seagrass species.
Yeah, I noticed that the difference between the two control sites for both pH and oxygen was greater than the difference between the control site and the plot that you were comparing it to. What are the reasons for that variability, and could that be part of the difference that you're seeing?
Great question. If only the presentation stayed blurrier for longer, maybe nobody would have noticed. I think it's because the newer eelgrass site further south in the inlet has substantial freshwater input, and freshwater has a huge influence on the pH of the local environment. Freshwater is much lower in pH than seawater, so that output there is just bringing the whole southerly site down, both the eelgrass and the bare areas.
Jeff, a question for you. Was Joemma Beach restoration, is that partly chosen because of the characteristics of the stressors there? And can you tell us about what stressors at Joemma might be affecting eelgrass recovery, restoration there?
So Joemma Beach State Park was selected because it was one of our recipient sites to verify the model that was developed in 2012. And we planted in a shallow zone and in a deep zone at Joemma, and both test plots to verify that model did well. We then went back in 2015 and conducted our large-scale restoration. The stressors that we're faced with there are burrowing organisms, and that was the reason for the development of the burlap method to try to minimize burrowing and keep the plants intact or in place. And then the other stressor that we're faced with there is abundance of macroalgae, green algae, particularly, and that comes in and can smother the eelgrass transplants and cause vast mortalities.
Question over here.
Are those the same reasons that eelgrass beds are in decline in general? Those same stressors?
The burrowing organisms, not necessarily. We've been able to establish plants there, and there still are burrowing evidence of burrowing organisms at Joemma Beach State Park, and they're just using the interstitial spaces between the plants and the rhizome mat. The green algae is definitely a concern. It's in an established bed. I think the bed can withstand some abundance of green algae, but in restoration efforts, it's a no-win case. I've come back to sites where we have 3 feet of green algae over test plots, and I'm pretty confident the eelgrass is not there any longer.
Yes, Mike, I'm wondering whether you have had a chance to do transect measurements around the mature area to figure out the area of influence where the eelgrass patch, that mature eelgrass patch, has overall?
Yeah, that's another great question. We have done that work, not at restoration plots, but at established natural beds. I will say that I think it depends a lot on the particulars of water motion at the site, in which direction the water is flowing, given the tidal cycle. But we have seen pretty marked effects at particular times of day within 5 meters of the meadow. So there is this spillover of enhanced oxygen and higher pH within that perimeter of the grass in certain flow conditions. If water's moving really fast, we can't measure it.